Ted and I pick up where John Calvin and Martin Luther left off. And we feel now in the last 6 years we pretty well got it all solved. And Ted's contention is that if Martin and John only would have had two more beers together, there probably wouldn't have been a division. I don't know just how that all works out. But I'm here today to just informally share with you one of the most exciting developments in my ministry. And I want to emphasize the word informal. I didn't expect this larger group. I really expected a table full, and I expected just to sit with some conversation. But I'll make a little presentation and then open it up to questions and answers. I'll give you a little history of what I'm going to talk about first. As Ted said, I've been director of Project Philip of the World Home Bible League for just about 8 years. That's an administrative, selling, writing position in a nice, secure, insulated little world away from all the problems and reality of the church. I observed churches in Taiwan that were growing using our materials, growing at a rate of 1,500 baptisms per month, and we sustained that rate now for 3 years. In the Philippines, incidentally, I understand that there's a denomination that took this particular program called Project Philip. In January 1977, they had 5,000 families, and by mid-1978 had grown to 15,000 families. Things are a little more open there than they are in the West. Well, anyway, I looked at all of this. I studied this in 1974 and 75 and wondered why it was that churches using materials that I wrote for the West could grow like wildfire. That wasn't the way it was supposed to be, but they just took the Western materials and used them and they went. And churches in the West here, for whom the materials were written, weren't growing. So I learned what they were doing differently than we were, and I took that back and rewrote it in a form called the Circle of Evangelism. And then over the previous 2 years, 1976 and 77, we trained approximately 1,500 churches in this Circle of Evangelism using film strips and some other principles. I still wasn't satisfied with the results. Those churches that did use the program started to grow, but I was very disappointed in the fact that only about 20% of those that ran through the seminar were actually able to get the program going. And I knew that there was something more, and I didn't know what it was. I guess at this point, as I look back, it was the fact that we were in religious marketing. And whenever a corporation or whenever a church was interested enough in spreading the gospel, they could take the marketing principles and it would work. I'm speaking very commercially, but it just wasn't all clicking. There were things that I didn't understand. So in a rather unusual act that caused a little flutter and flurry at the Bible League, I asked to be relieved of my position for at least 3 years to return to the parish pastorate and find out firsthand what was wrong, what was going on. And there begins our story. I accepted a call to Highland Hills Christian Reformed Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. The church is 26 years old. We have about 600 people in our worship services morning, and we're a little different than the Lutherans. They come back again at night. Ted often said, as you know, Nicodemus could never have been a Lutheran because he came to Jesus at night. Anyway, it's a Dutch church, very predominantly Dutch, located in a Polish Catholic community that isn't growing. Now, you want a challenge for evangelism, you put a bunch of Hollanders among the Polacks and put some Christian Reformed and the other Catholics, and then make it an affluent community. The homes in our community vary from probably $50,000 to $100,000. You have just about the most impossible situation for evangelism apart from the inner city. The church had not grown for 26 years at all, evangelistically. Well, I ministered there for about 2 months, and I'll never forget when God first gave me the answer to the problems that I was wrestling with. It was at the end of October, maybe mid-November, I got up one morning, 2:30 in the morning, and walked into the living room and got down on my knees and just started to weep. I said, God, I can't do it. I don't know what in the world you got me into, but after the secure insulation of that administrative office and running all over, why in the world did I come back here to try to do evangelism out of this place? And all of a sudden, the idea came into my mind, and I can remember blurting it out, God, I can't do evangelism out of a lecture hall. And all of a sudden, I found out why the film strips and the circle of evangelism wasn't working in a lot of churches. Because a lot of churches are lecture halls. And Americans aren't really attracted to lecture halls anymore today. Well, out of that grew a whole new experiment. In a traditional church. Now, I didn't get rid of all my liabilities and go out to Southern California and start all over from scratch, man. We started with liabilities. We got Hollanders, and they're next to Germans and being stubborn. Boy, the theme song of our church is, "We shall not be moved." Huh? Right. Okay, so you're going to deal with churches like that, or you are dealing with churches like that. You have to find some kind of program that's going to work within the structure to change things. And out of all of this, I want to present four questions that will help organize my thoughts and communicate them to you, that this was the process that I went through. I asked myself, first of all, what is a church? I came to Highland Hills to test a church growth program, and God challenged me by saying, you want a church to grow, you better know what a church is. What is a church? And the second question that I confronted is, what is a layman? And then the third question, what is a pastor? And then I got answers to those three questions. Then we had the fourth question, what is the structure? I'll just give you the answers to those four questions. First of all, what is a church? Well, I have always been a little bit cynical, I guess, about the institutional church, a little bit rebellious. And I came back. I didn't really want to come back to Grand Rapids. It's the St. Louis, really, the Christian Reformed Church. We have 100 Christian Reformed and Reformed churches sitting on top of each other in a city that's 300,000 people only. And it's just stagnant. Somebody once said about the Christian Reformed Church, it's a lot like manure, you know. If you spread it around, it really causes things to grow. But when you get it all sitting on top of each other in Grand Rapids, it stings to high heaven. And maybe some of you feel that way a little bit about St. Louis. I don't know. But anyway, I began to read some books. And one of the first ones that is the most important book I think I've ever read in my life is Howard Snyder's Problem of Wineskins. And in this book, Howard Snyder quotes Peter Savage. Huh? And Peter Savage says that there are four models of the church today. And I looked at that and I compared that to 1 Corinthians 13, verses 1 to 3. Howard Snyder says, first of all, there are churches that are lecture halls. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, eloquent preachers, marvelous preachers, but have not love, I become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. My particular tradition emphasizes preaching. Our concept of Christianity is to park your carcass on the pew, look at the back of a dozen heads, pass judgment on whether or not I was eloquent that Sunday, go out the door, shake hands with a few people, comment about the coho fishing on Lake Michigan, disappear for 6 days, and come back and do it all over again on the seventh day. And that was our Christianity, a lecture hall kind of Christianity. Now, I'm being hard on the church. This isn't all, but there was an awfully lot of this. And Peter Savage says there's a second model, and that's theater Christianity. And then I don't know whether I ought to say it. I thought of my Lutheran friends. You know, we don't get up and down quite so often as you folks do. Peter Savage talks about the theater of the sacraments, you know, where you really have this whole thing set up. But I thought more of my fundamentalistic friends, and we have a lot of people in our church that way, who go from one gospel concert to another, and for whom Christianity is little more than religious entertainment, you know. They get their highs by hearing these quartets from down south. They'll pack our civic auditorium and what have you. Great, I'm not going to knock that, but that's still not the church. These great dramatic musical events. It's theater Christianity. Then Peter Savage says there's a third form that the church takes today. It's called a religious marketing corporation. And I thought of 1 Corinthians 13 that says, if I have faith so much as to remove mountains, and I thought of some of the people I know who really have a tremendous amount of faith. Look at all the money they're raising. Church buildings for $14 million, huh? You know all this sort of stuff. And the more I looked at this whole television Christianity type of thing, hey, that's really religious marketing. And that's what I've been involved in. I've been trying to design things that will help the church market Christianity. Now, I believe there's a legitimate place for that. I believe God's given us minds, and we ought to use it. But I found that you can't apply good marketing techniques if there isn't anything inside. And then the final thing Peter Savage says is that the church, some churches have become nothing more than social clubs. They've really degenerated into ethnic groups that gather together, look at one another, and pontificate about the ills of the world. And I saw some of that, too. And so, you know, I looked at all of that, and I began to wonder, well, what is the church? What's it all about? Howard Snyder says that we're in a fellowship crisis today. And it's a real tremendous crisis. In our churches, there's a kind of cheap fellowship, parallel to Bonhoeffer's cheap grace. It's not really the koinonia of the Holy Spirit, but it's something that's easily duplicated at the Rotary or Kiwanis Club or the Isaac Walton League, of which I was the executive secretary for 7 years. I found a lot of the same comradie, a lot of the same fellowship at these particular places. And then I began to read some stuff by Bruce Larson, and Bruce Larson said that one of the problems of the church today is that it dealt only in academic doctrine. One of the reasons why we have Jonestowns and why we have the sects that grow up is because we're so busy talking about abstract things. He says the Bible is really a book, not of abstract doctrine, but of relational doctrine, relational theology. It teaches us how to get along with God and how to get along with man, starting with the fundamental problem of humanity, the removal of sin by the blood of Christ on the cross of Calvary. And then working out from that, all you read Ephesians 1 in light of that glorious concept where Paul speaks about the mystery of God's will, uniting all things in Jesus Christ, the beautiful thing of reconciliation. That's what the church ought to be involved in. It ought to be involved in reconciliation theology. And I don't mean that in a cheap sense. I mean that based in being born again in the blood of Christ, real forgiveness, real regeneration by the Holy Spirit, and then out of that, let our emphasis be on teaching people in the power of the Spirit how to get along with one another. So we redefined our church. Maybe it's not a good definition, I don't know, but it's communicated to our people. And I said, look, Highland Hills is not going to be a lecture hall. It's going to be God's paradise-building society on earth. I believe that God has called us to build a paradise. And that paradise is built on a totally unique concept of love found in John 13, 34. No other kind of love is available like this. It can never be imitated. It can never be cheapened at all. It's the body love of Jesus Christ. Jesus said, a new commandment give I, that you love one another. I don't know how many of you have ever stumbled over that verse. But if I would have been one of the disciples at that time, I would have said, look, that's nonsense. You've talked about love all your life. And the Lord would have replied, I'm sure, but I'm giving you a whole new reason for loving one another. And maybe the best way that I can explain that reason is with a homely illustration. I love to ice fish. People ask why. I say, well, it's the same as mountain climbing. Mountains are there to be climbed. Ice is there to be sat on. Don't ask me why, but I just go bananas about ice fishing. Well, one winter we had a thaw in February, and I decided I still was going to go, and my wife said the ice is rotten, and we had our usual argument, and I went anyway because she doesn't know a thing about ice fishing. And I went out there and sat on the ice and fished, and on the way in, of course, her predictions came true. I fell through. Now, not all the way. Just with this leg. And I spread-eagled out on the ice, and I had a great big ice spud on my shoulder, real thick bar of steel, and just as it clanged from shoulder height down onto the ice, I managed to get the third finger of my left hand under it. I had a little red glove on. I didn't notice it because I had other things on my mind, so I, you know, swam out of the hole, kind of got everything, got up on shore. And then I noticed that that finger was tingling just a little bit. So I took my glove off, and man, that thing was mashed. It was Hamburg like I'd never seen in my life. My fishing partner looked at me and said, hey, John, your face is white. I said, man, you think my face looks bad, Gary? Look at the third finger on my left hand. You know, it's really bad. Then my toes started to tingle. And then my stomach started to churn. I said, hey, stomach, I got enough problem right now with this thing without having to worry about that, what are you coming up on me, see? And so every part of my body was concerned about that third finger on my left hand. I really hadn't paid any attention to it since the day I put my wedding ring on it. But now it was hurting, and I was hurting all over. I've got four fingers here. I've also got three brothers. I want to tell you, my relationship to these four fingers is a lot different than my relationship to my three brothers. I love them, but these are part of me. And that's what the church is. You're not my brother, my sister. You're part of the same body I occupy. And that's Christ's body. And the reason the church isn't growing today is because we have lost that dimension that is totally, radically unique. There's nothing like it in all the world. And what we have is just a cheap imitation oftentimes of Kiwanis Fellowship. And is there any wonder why the world passes by and says to us, what do you have to offer? I believe we have to get back to that paradise-building society where our people learn how to love one another in the Spirit as members of the body of Christ. Well, that's nice theology, nice thought, but how do you do it? Well, that brings us to the second question, what is a layman? Well, yeah, there's so much you could say about that, huh? As I looked at our church, I thought there are three false views of the laity that I'm observing here. One was brought forward by one of our converts, beautiful girl, 26 years old. She hadn't gone to church for 10 years. She was Catholic in background. Marvelously transformed. She said to me one night in a Bible study, John, you know, my parents have said to me that since I've become so religious, I really ought to be a nun. You know, that's funny about Catholics. They can't understand that a layman can really be turned on for religion. I said, oh, Jackie, that's just not for Catholics. That's for Protestants, too. The minute you get a young guy that's really excited about Christ, what's the first thing you say? Oh, he ought to go in the ministry, right? As if somehow a layman can't be a full-time turned-on Christian. And all of a sudden that opened up for me a whole new area of thought. And I look at laity in three false views. There's, first of all, this professional versus non-professional type of thing, where if you're really turned on, you go and you become a clergyman, or in some denominations, a clergywoman today. Hmm? Or if you're not a professional, non-professional, then you have what we call the recipient view of Christianity. And that's very prevalent in the Christian Reformed Church. The recipient view says that the total obligation that a layman has is to come and sit and receive. He comes and he receives on Sunday morning. He wants to be fed, so to speak, and he pays his church budget as an obligation for that, and then he goes and leaves. The third thing is the volunteer view of Christianity. Well, that's a little different than the recipient view, and that fellow looks at his life and he says, well, now I got to make a choice, huh? I got my business, I got my family, I got my recreation, I got this, that. Oh, yeah, and over here I got church. Now I got a compartmentalized life with about seven different things, and I got to choose somewhere in there, and I have to squeeze some time out for the church. Every one of those three views is deeply heretical. But they're all very prevalent in our churches today. What is a layman? He is a full-time, professional, paradise builder, gifted by the Holy Spirit with special spiritual trades or gifts. A full-time, professional, paradise builder, gifted by the Holy Spirit with special spiritual trades or gifts. And I tried to point out that to my people. I said, if you think I've come here to do your sick calling, forget about it. I'm going back to the league in 3 years. Matter of fact, the only way I'll stay with you is if at the end of the three-year period, you people have responded so much that John DeVries really isn't necessary. Then I'll stay. But if you think I've come to play the game for you, you're crazy. You're the team, I'm the coach, and I want to train you how to minister to one another and how to build a paradise together. Well, that brought us into the third area, what was my role, and I'm not going to take much time on that. Elton Trueblood's definition of the pastor still is Ephesians 4:11. Why is the pastor there? to call on the sick, to do the pastoral counseling. One of the reasons why we have so many divorces today is because we've got so many professional marriage counselors. I really believe that with all my heart. I think Aunt Sarah did an awful lot more to hold a lot of marriages together than some of the trained counselors that we have today. And the very fabric of society has come unglued. And if you think professional counselors can keep that thing together, man, you are the most naive person I've run into. We have to have a whole new paradise of love relationships where that pressure surrounds one another and where they don't have to go to a $60 an hour counselor to get things straightened out, but where they can turn to a loving Christian next door to them and say, "Hey man, Jane and I had a terrible time. Can't you help us? Won't you get down on your knees and pray with us?" I'm not knocking professional counseling, but brother, this is the dimension that's missing. And a pastor comes to teach his people how to counsel, not to do the counseling for them. He comes to teach his people how to call on the sick, not to call on the sick for them. How to exercise their spiritual gifts in prophesying and exhorting one another, not to do it all for them. And until you get to that concept, I think you really come back to the real church. Well, that brings us to the fourth thing. What is the structure? So you can understand what the church is and what the layman is and what the pastor is. But what about the structure? How do you restructure all of this? Well, the key word, of course, when you're restructuring a traditional church is experiment. I never try to sell a permanent program. I think that's really bad. And I never come to my church and say, "Hey, I got the answer. Man, let's go." I say, "Hey, I got an idea. Do I have some volunteers that will experiment with this program for 6 months? And after the end of the 6 month period, tell me how you liked it. If it doesn't work, we'll junk it and try something else. But if it does work, then I know you want to keep on going." And so that's the way we sold this new program. We said, "We're going to try it for 6 months. Okay, I'll train you how to do it." And I said, "Now, as far as I'm concerned, the only way that you're really going to rediscover the church is if you meet together in small groups." Oh, you want to watch him go up the wall fast. Small groups. That's almost a swear word. So we changed the terminology and we call it little churches. And they swallowed that a little bit easier. You know, some of them still say, "Well, that's schismatic," and so on. But we got over that pretty well. But we found the idea of little churches worked better. Now, when I came there, we have a system of elders just like the Lutheran church. And we have about 175 families in the church. And each elder, we've got 12 elders. So each elder has about 15 names. And he is what we call a district, see? And he's supposed to be the spiritual pastor over that district. Now, that's an important starting point if you're going to restructure the church, that you give each pastor a district and you tell them this church doesn't have one minister, this church has 13 ministers. You guys are 12 of them. I'm just one. I'm the teaching, preaching minister. You guys are the spiritual pastors of the congregation. Now, these districts were made not geographically, not age-wise, but quite arbitrarily. We went through the church directory and counted all the families, 1 to 12, put all the 1s together, all the 2s together, all the 3s together, all the 4s. Then we did just a little bit of juggling, so Ma and Pa weren't in there with the married kids. We didn't figure that was too good. But we tried in each district to get a balance of the church, old, middle, and young. And then along with this, we did one experiment where we made a district up of just everybody under 30 years old. We said, maybe they'll get along better together. You know that's our worst district? It really is. Young people, young married couples, desperately need the experience and advice of the older people. And the older people really need the younger ones. And those are our liveliest groups. All right. The second thing that we did was call each district together one at a time. And I had the elder, and we have a deacon system in our church, so I had one elder and one deacon assigned to each one of these districts. And we had them over at the parsonage. They just spent $10,000 remodeling the parsonage, so we had to show this thing off. And that was a nice way to get them all to come, because they were really curious about the parsonage. They didn't care two hoots about this new program. But anyway, I got them down in the basement, and I had a captured audience. I sat them all on the floor down there, really gave them the old 1-2 about this program. Wrote it up and said, now for 6 months from January to June, I've come to experiment. I want you to carry this thing out. I want you to meet in home. No more than 15 people. So out of a district, maybe we'll have one or two or three little churches. And I want you to do 5 things. I want you to meet every other Sunday night. Don't give me this garbage, you don't have time. If you don't have time, forget about the program. Don't come once a month. If you don't have commitment, forget it. I got to have people that are committed. And you can't do it less than once every other week. So you meet after the evening service in somebody's home. We'll start at 8 and we'll go to about 11 or 11:30. I want you to do 5 things. First of all, when you come to that home, I want you to praise the Lord with songs. Sing for about a half hour. And you don't just have to have it out of our official church songbook, you know. There's another songbook. It's entitled Hymns Lutherans Love to Sing. Have you ever seen it? You know? As if you don't love to sing the ones out of your regular songbook. Well, we have those kind of songbooks, too, in our group. And so we sang songs together for a half hour. And at the end of the half hour, I said, now, I want you just to go around the circle and say 1 or 2 things as to why you're thankful for what God has done in the last 2 weeks. You ought to see people get scared, hey? It's almost a riot. Well, we tried for a couple of weeks, and finally I said, well, for Pete's sake, you don't have to be cured from leprosy every week to have something to say. God does do little things, you know. And, well, then they started to open up a little bit more. And then we had a time of prayer, just sentence prayers. God, I thank you for this. I thank you for that. Not everybody participated. Our people aren't all that eager and able to pray out loud, but it got things flowing. So it was a time of praise. The second thing we did was Bible study. And that, too, I think was very unique. It's called word meditation. I preached a sermon about it and said, is your prayer life boring? You know why? Because it's probably a one-way monologue. And most of us are bored by one-way monologues. You ever keep your mouth shut long enough to listen to God speak to you? I'd like to tell you 2 things. He speaks English, and he speaks propositionally in his book. Now, if your prayer life would consist of more than calling in your morning grocery order to the Lord, would consist of keeping your mouth shut and taking a verse every single day and rolling it over and over in your mind and letting the Lord speak to you and apply that verse to your life, you're going to have a whole new dimension in your life. Now, here's what I want you to do. I'll give you 1 word for every fortnight. Grace, power, love. I'll give you 14 texts in which that word or concept appears. I want you to take a text a day. When you get up in the morning, wash your mind, cleanse it. Then I want you to take that text and write it on a card or put it in your mind, roll it over all day long, and when you get home at night, write down your experience. What did God say to you? I don't want a theological discussion. I don't want you to looking at the commentaries. I want you to read the passage in context, and then I want God to speak to you. And when you come for Bible study, you know what you're going to do? You just tell the others what God said. Wow. We had some meetings that literally lasted till 1 or 1:30 in the morning. Hey, and these are with Dutch people who aren't used to expressing themselves. And we just opened the meeting up and we said, what text did appear best to you this week? Well, many of them were all clamoring to get in at the same time. And we found now in the groups that are really working that there's no way we can get done with 14 texts. So they usually pick 4 or 5, and it takes them an hour to an hour and a half to get through with it. One of the best Bible study methods that I've ever come across. Then we have 3 other things very quickly that we do. The third thing is that in each little church, we have a home missionary. He's a person, a man, a wife, a team, that are trained in the Kennedy method of evangelism, coupled with our film strip program. They go out on Wednesday nights to teach film strips and to use the Kennedy approach or whatever approach they happen to have fallen into in bringing men and women to Christ. But now instead of bringing them into our big church, they bring them into the little church. And we're finding that these little churches are magnets that draw and hold these new families. And what has happened is that the little church slides them into the big church. And so the people are ringed by 15 friends, and they think that big church is the most fantastically friendly place in all the world. They don't know what it's really like. You know, I don't mean that. But what you've done, what God has done, is He changed the whole personality of the church within 3 months. I just couldn't believe it. And this church has the reputation for being so phenomenally friendly now. I've had some kids come over way from 25 miles away. They're coming to church regularly. They've been here for 6 months. They've never gone to church. What in the world are you doing coming all the way across town? They said, we've tried all kinds of churches. This is the only one that's ever really welcomed us. Been friendly, but it's because of that little church thing. And I believe that that's the missing link in evangelism today. The reason why the churches in Taiwan and the Philippines are growing so much is because they're using homes, and they're growing out of homes, and that's the worldwide revival today. And that's what one of the ingredients our churches have to have. Then, very quickly, we have service projects. Each little church has its own shut-in, rest home services to keep it looking out, and we also have world missions. Each little church has its own world missionary. And that program now is well into its second year. The novelty is worn off, the initial excitement is gone, it has stabilized, and it's growing. It's very strong and healthy. It is nowhere near, overall, a true breakthrough yet, where people are really opening up and sharing with one another. I'm concerned about that. We got about 3 or 4 where that's happening. But the rest are kind of keeping their face up and their pride, and they're not really trusting one another yet. But it is growing, and the thing that delights me so much is that there is constant progress in it. In the first year, I believe that this program was very instrumental in the growth of the church. In the first 12 months of using this program, we have had, through our pastor's class, 80 new members. And of this, approximately 25% come from no church background at all. This is in a church that hasn't grown at all. We're just really delighted. As I said, I didn't anticipate a large crowd today, and I have 8 mimeographed folders about the whole program, giving the foundation and giving about 12 or 13 word studies in it. And I'd like to offer these to the pastors that are here today. It will be made available in a booklet form in mid-February from the World Home Bible League. You can also get it from Ted's office. Any questions that any of you have? Yes? Permanently. You bet. That's just, I think it's a legitimate sales tool. I don't want to keep it going if the people don't want it. When we reached the period in June, we never even asked the question whether we should continue. They were just so sold on it that they had come to know and love each other in a dimension they'd never had before. I had one elder, he's 65 years old. He said, John, I've been in the church 30 years. And he started to cry as he said this to me. He's one of the best guys we got. He said, you know, this program makes me so bad, so sad. And I said, well, why, Claire? He said, it took me 30 years to find out what the church is all about. And he says, I'm 65 years old. I look back on the 30 years as elder in the church, and he says, I could weep. How come we haven't known this before? And so it's really, really working. When you get people that committed, it's pretty permanent. You said it. Okay. Yeah. Say, are you sure you're in the Lutheran church? Yeah, you keep talking, I'm going to call you a Calvinist pretty quick. Yeah. he wants to know how you'd start. I really don't know. That wasn't my situation. I had intended to start with 1 or 2 groups, and the elders of the church said, John, you blow it. You got to start with all 12 of us. I said, you're out of your mind. I wouldn't start with 12. Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing. They said, sorry, that's the way it's going to be, and we all want to run with it. So that's kind of the sleeper that I didn't throw in, but, you know, it was a unique situation. I would say explain it to your consistory. Emphasize, or to your church council, or whatever you call it, emphasize the experimental aspect and ask for one or two elders to lead one or two districts. And have them give monthly reports so that you avoid all of the schism and all of the division and this sort of thing. But just start with the little fellowship of real believers within that congregation. But start not in secret. Start publicly. Let the whole church know what you're doing so that they aren't all uptight. And really ride that experimental type of thing. I see. Oh, that's a good thing. Great. Thank you. There was a couple other questions back, way in the back. Okay, here, then. Yeah, okay. No, I'm Christian Reform. I wish I had a picture of the look on your face right now. You wonder how Fliston got in here, huh? I have frankly been accused of everything. theologically, a synergist, a Calvinist, an Arminian, and charismatic, and all of this sort of thing. The movement that we're talking about certainly is somewhat in the charismatic movement. You'll find that there, but no way limited to it. One of the things that has really surprised me as I started reading is the extent of this small group movement, not just in the church, but in industry, and in sales, and wherever you turn. And oftentimes, the church is Johnny-come-lately, and that's true with the mainline denominations today. Our whole secular society today is penetrated with the small groups. Carl Rogers calls it the social revolution of the 70s. And I'm just waking up to it. The second thing that I found is the five things that I mentioned to you, praise, Bible study, and so on, were things that we arrived at without ever reading, without doing any research. And now as I'm doing research on the movement, I'm finding that those five functions occur in different formats, but the five basic functions occur in most of these little groups. And you'll find them just spread everywhere. They're not the product of the charismatic movement or Pentecostal or anything. They're just all through society today. Yes. Yes. Oh, no. It doesn't cause problems because it's all done through our church consistory. It's done through our church order, see? Our church order says that the elders are the spiritual overseers of our church. And all I'm saying, look, guys, stop thinking that spiritual overseeing is sitting here debating about whether we ought to pull the weeds out of the parking lot. You know, why don't you guys go out and do some spiritual overseeing once and be what you're called to be? And I can defend that anyway. And we're having a constant flow of visitors from the other Reformed and Lutheran churches. Matter of fact, we have Lutherans meet with our little churches quite regularly out of the Grand Rapids area. And it is spreading. There's a tremendous amount of interest. I've never been involved in anything where the interest has been as great as what it is in this particular program. Yes. Yes. We did a little fiddling with them this summer to rearrange some of the leadership, but our idea is to leave them intact and let them split by growth. But 12 is really the magic number. If they get beyond 12, you don't have any conversation. I'm leading one now where we've got 20 people, and it's like pulling teeth. It is terrible. So you've got to get between 8 and 12, and you've got to have a few extroverts in the crowd, and then away they go. That's the human dynamics of the thing. Easy and then done.
How do the little churches day and the rest of its program?
The little churches, first of all, serve as kind of committees for the big church. When we have social projects such as transportation or something, we assign it to one of the little churches to carry out. A tutoring project in the inner city, one of the little churches is taking care of that. So it's become a beautiful committee arm for the whole church. Second, they meet as a total district. Three or four little churches will meet together as a district once every 3 or 4 months for fellowship suppers, and that way get the people in who aren't going to the little church along with the kids. I would say overall it's dramatically improved our church attendance on Sunday. Attendance has much more meaning for the people today than it did when I came. Yeah.
Good question. What do you do for the people who don't come on Sunday?
Pray a lot about them. No, we gave no consideration to geography at all, and that doesn't seem to bother. We have people traveling as far as 20 to 25 miles to get to a little church. It's not ideal, but that's the way it is. The first question was, we have approximately 30-35% of the church not involved in this little church program, and we are using social friendship. The little church prays for these people, but then offers to take them out for coffee and this type of thing. We're working on getting them in, but not by real ecclesiastical pressure, but by trying to win their friendship and then say, hey, come on along. We've just got the most fantastic thing going. You, of course, won't ever get 100%. Yeah. Well, the answer to that is simply that you structured it through your church constitution. You know, each one of your elders are in charge of a district or a group. We have a monthly reporting session and leaders training meeting in which they're to pour in all the content of the things that happen. It's very, very closely supervised by the appointed leadership of the church. It's impossible for it to be schismatic under them. You bet. Very, very closely. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jack.